A high-profile criminal investigation into hazing at a mainline football program comes to a quiet close. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Back in March, Chester County District Attorney Tom Hogan announced assault charges against three varsity players, part of an alleged culture of abuse. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that the case has ended with a plea deal.
Details of the 2005 complaint were ugly and splashed all over nightly news reports, like this one from ABC6.
The authorities say in October 15 of last year, things reached a darker, violent level. That's when they say that three 17-year-old members of the team held down a 14-year-old freshman and violated him with a broom handle.
The three were charged with criminal assault, among other offenses. Here's District Attorney Tom Hogan announcing the charges, recorded by CBS3.
This is just bullying. And in Chester County, we won't stand for bullying.
Parents and students in the well-to-do Tredyffrin Easttown School District reacted with shock and, in some cases, disbelief. 9 months after that announcement, and on the day the trial was set to begin, it's over. The three co-defendants have admitted to a lower-level summary offense of harassment. A joint statement from the DA's office and lawyers for the defendants offered new details of the incident, saying the three players pinned the underclassman and, quote, poked the victim with a broomstick in the leg. Dorian Ross is the father of one of the co-defendants and a vocal critic of the DA's investigation.
You know, I'm still outraged. I'm relieved of the outcome, but I'm still outraged.
Ross says he wanted to challenge the charges in court, but his son chose to avoid a trial. The summary offense can be wiped from defendants' records in 6 months, but the impact on the school district is lasting. The head football coach resigned, and a new position of athletic director was created to oversee middle and high school sports. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benchoff.
Testimony resumed today in the civil trial tied to 2013's deadly building collapse in Center City, Philadelphia. WHYY's Aaron Moselle reports that defense attorneys asked a former and current city official about a series of inflammatory emails sent shortly before the June 5th tragedy.
Before the collapse, Thomas Sidmans was Richard Basciano's right-hand man for a demolition project taking place along the 2100 block of Market Street. Basciano wanted his buildings to come down so he could eventually build his dream, a modern mixed-use development featuring a pair of sparkling towers. One of the properties, the Hoagie City Building, was next to a busy Salvation Army thrift store. For weeks, Sidmans traded emails and phone calls with the charity because the project's demolition team needed to access the roof of the thrift store to take down the four-story building safely. Some of the exchanges used dire language, warning the Salvation Army that, quote, life and limb were at stake. On the stand, former Deputy Mayor for Economic Development Alan Greenberger said he never read those emails because he rarely checked his official email account. He said he used a different address for day-to-day correspondence. John Mondelak, the city's senior director of real estate development, testified that he did see the emails but disregarded them because they were so, quote, outrageous. It's unclear if Sidman's language was rooted in real danger or if he was simply trying to pressure the Salvation Army into giving him access to their store's roof. The two sides never reached an agreement. On June 5, 2013, an unbraced three-story wall of the Hoagie City Building collapsed onto and crushed the thrift store, killing six and injuring 13 others. I'm Aaron Moselle, WHYY News.
Pennsylvania lawmakers reconvene today to swear in new and old members and to kick off another two-year legislative session. Both the House and Senate are ushering in historic GOP majorities. Allegheny County Republican Mike Terzai was sworn in for a second term as House Speaker. He gave a largely positive address to his chamber, recapping conservative successes like fending off Democratic Governor Tom Wolf's attempts to pass tax increases, though Terzai did allude to challenges ahead.
We found ways to meet our obligations while holding the line on broad-based taxes. We've reduced debt. We have more to do.
Now, more to do refers to the fact that Pennsylvania is entering its new session with a budget expected to fall over $600 million short of projected revenue. And that's on top of a structural deficit valued at nearly $2 billion. Meanwhile, as the lawmakers new and returning in Harrisburg were sworn in today, Governor Wolf begins the second half of his term. WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies sat down with Wolf to reflect on his first 2 years in office.
Well, Governor Wolf, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's good to be here.
You've been in the job 2 years. What surprised you about being governor?
Actually, there were not a lot of surprises. I knew it was going to be a hard job, but I ran for the office because I thought I could do important things for Pennsylvania, and that was confirmed. I'm going to continue to work to make Pennsylvania better.
Do you have a signature accomplishment?
I think there are a couple. I think the big thing, I ran first and foremost on digging ourselves out of the hole that was dug in terms of education funding. And over the last 2 years, the investment we've made in education at all levels in the last 2 years is higher than I think any governor in the history of Pennsylvania. So I'm proud of that. The legalization of medical marijuana was a big thing. Reform of the liquor system. I ran on modernization, and I think we've done that first time since Prohibition. Expanded Medicaid. There are now almost 700,000 people with health insurance who didn't have it before. We have a fair funding formula for education. So there are a lot of good things that happened. One of the things that I enjoyed most about this job was how all of us came together to work on the opioid crisis.
On education, you've clearly gotten less than you had hoped at each point. And while there is a fairer funding formula that everybody agrees more equitably distributes money based on need and student population, it still only applies to a very small fraction of state education funding now, right?
Well, it applies to all the new dollars. And so the fact that I've gotten $415 million for K-12 education increase in education funding, those dollars are all subject to the fair funding formula. Again, keep in mind, before I came into the position, Pennsylvania was one of only three states without a fair funding formula.
In your first budget, you came in proposing sweeping changes in the state income tax, the sales tax, which would raise those but reduce property taxes and impose a shale extraction tax and increase education funding. That battle went on months beyond the deadline for passing a budget, had impacts on nonprofit groups and charitable institutions. Your second budget, you scaled back, you compromised earlier, and reached an agreement. What's the difference in your approach in those two?
I think I learned a little bit more about how to work with the legislature. We actually, I think, can't forget that it was late, but in November and December, we did reach a deal on a very good budget, I thought. And it actually passed the Senate, and the authorization passed the House before a third consideration of the bill, which would have been typically a pro forma thing. The House adjourned for the holidays. So we actually had a good deal, and it took me some time to reach that compromise, but we got it, and it was a pretty good budget. Didn't get even that when that first budget went in later in 2016. I think the 2016-17 budget came in on time, pretty much on time, with, again, $215 million more in K-12 education.
You said you'd learned something. What have you learned about dealing with the legislature that you didn't know?
Well, I think just learning how to work with them a little better, and I think we all agreed that we had a lot of areas where we disagreed, and we agreed that we would work on those areas where we did agree. And I think there was broad support for some increase in education funding, which is a big change from the prior administration, and I'm very proud of that. And I think there was able to identify folks in the legislature who agreed with me that we needed to do more for education.
You have a legislature now that's more Republican than it was when you became office. You have an incoming Republican president who has an agenda that certainly doesn't square with yours. How do you deal with the coming period?
The goal is to make lives of middle-class Pennsylvanians better. And again, the focus on education, for one thing, is and continues to be aimed solely at doing that. We're creating opportunities for families who want their children to have access to an education system that will give them the opportunities they need. So I think that was important over the last 2 years. I argue it's still important now, and I think there are a lot of members of the legislature, Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals, who believe that's true.
You're running for re-election in 2 years, and it seems possible, even likely, that one or more of the Republican candidates will be members of the legislature, particularly the Senate, who you're going to have to deal with to get things done. It will be in their interests to undermine your success. Does this present a special challenge to you?
Well, I think that's true to a certain extent. On the other hand, they're going to have to be careful because the people of Pennsylvania want their government to actually work. And I think they'll hold accountable whichever candidate they think is trying to mess up the works.
Do you have a favorite moment from the past 2 years, a moment that said, gosh, what a great job?
I think that there were a lot. But I think my favorite moment was working with the legislature, and I guess the key moment was the speech to the joint session on the opioid crisis. This is something that really cuts across political boundaries, ideological boundaries, chambers, and all of us have worked together, I think, in the early going. We have more to do, but done a lot of good things to address the opioid crisis. I think Pennsylvania is a leader in the country in terms of what we're doing to address this epidemic, and I think that's a high point.
Governor Wolf, thank you so much for being with us.
Dave, it's been great being with you.
Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf spoke with WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies. As we embark on the new year, let's check out the Philadelphia region tech scene with Technically Philly lead reporter Roberto Torres. Roberto, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having me.
And before we look ahead, let's get perspective. Give us an overview of what transpired in 2016 of note.
2016 was a very interesting year for the Philadelphia tech scene. There was a lot of connection within companies, and a lot of interesting startups abound. We saw one or two exits, a lot of investment coming in, both from within the ecosystem and from other cities. I think a lot of what's going to happen in 2017 depends on the base that was set up this past year.
And so describe in more detail what you mean by an ecosystem.
Sure. There are a number of very large, what we call anchor institutions. You know, you have, for example, the University of Pennsylvania, which set up a 58,000 square foot research center in Grays Ferry. You have, besides local organizations and local universities, there are many startups that are beginning to connect with them. Philadelphia is a very small, big town, so to speak. And I think a lot of what's playing out is very interesting because there's a lot of connection between those two kinds of institutions.
Are universities the prime driver in the Philadelphia region?
That's a very good question. I think we see some interesting initiatives come out of it. But I would say there's definitely a mix of both large and mid-sized startups that are going to be doing some very interesting stuff next year.
On the municipal side, what innovations can we anticipate from City Hall?
Right. City Hall. 2016 was an interesting year for the Kenney administration, still setting up shop and getting the key people in place. We saw the city's website go from a very early rough alpha to a beta version, which means that there are now more services that are available under that platform. I think we're going to see the final version of the new website for Philly roll out in 2017 with some interesting and more perhaps modern features.
Will that rollout in turn put Philadelphia in the vanguard among similar sized municipalities, or are we still playing catch up?
I think to a certain extent we're still playing catch up. There was a general sense of a lag there in developing that platform, but I think it's definitely showing some interest now.
Let's get personal and talk toys. Of course, the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas officially begins Thursday. What are some gadgets of interest?
Anything related to IoT, the Internet of Things, is going to be very popular. Of course, the whole Amazon Echo was very popular among Christmas gifts this year. But I'm more interested in locally made gadgets. There's a lot of interesting both stuff coming out of maker spaces and little trinkets here and there that are interesting to watch as well in 2017.
For example?
There's a local company called Stratus that dabbles in that IoT spectrum of the tech industry that is doing some very interesting stuff with regards to smart locks and home control stuff. I think that's interesting.
Interestingly enough, Tech Philly's most read story apparently last year was kind of low tech, about reducing water and energy consumption.
Yeah, we're still wondering about that. We don't know what happened. It just very wildly interesting for some reason. We took a longer look into what was interesting in 2016, and I think our coverage says that 2017 is going to be the year of health IT, actually. There were very interesting initiatives, both from the funding side, from startup creation, that I think are going to drive the narrative next year.
The potential is unlimited in health IT. What's realistic, though, in the short term?
I think there's a big interest both from investor side is software. There's a big push for health-related software that has people interested both beyond the borders of Philadelphia and within the ecosystem. In order for that to develop, though, there's going to be we need for a bigger connection, a more frequent connection between the larger anchor institutions like Penn and CHOP with smaller startups. And I think they're, to a certain degree, they're getting there. There was a very interesting initiative announced right at the end of the year. It's a partnership between Safeguard Scientifics, Ben Franklin Technology Partners. It's going to be an $8 million fund for investing in health startups. I think we're going to see some interesting stuff come out of there. I'm definitely watching the startups that get funding from that cohort, because I understand it that although they're early stage, they already have a proven business model. So I'm very interested in what's going to come out of there.
Back to that term ecosystem. Again, relative to other cities that have established ecosystems, would you consider Philadelphia to be a net draw to those interested in finding a career here in that field?
I think there's a big potential for it. One thing that it needs to do is to take care of its own platform, of the things that it's offering talent from outside the city. Both things like city tax and schools and infrastructure are going to be key in drawing in that talent from outside of Philadelphia.
Roberto, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you.
That's Technically Philly lead reporter Roberto Torres. Competitive axe throwing. Yes, competitive axe throwing. It's moved out of the woods and into a converted Philadelphia warehouse. WHYY's Rob Zavatsky introduces us to Urban Axes. That's where city folk can find their inner lumberjack.
Wait till both axes are thrown before you pick them up. So if I'm playing with you, you throw, then I throw. You know, wait till they're both in there. Other than that, you know, it's an axe. Be cool. Don't be a complete idiot. More importantly, guys, have a great time the entire time.
Inside a converted warehouse, Brian Langan is teaching a group of newbies the rules of competitive axe throwing. He works for Urban Axes in Philadelphia's Kensington neighborhood. Langan, who is also an artist and musician, has been teaching people the right way to throw an axe for a few months.
Aim the axe at the bullseye, cross your other hand over, make an X out of your thumbs, and in one motion you're going to shift forward and shift back to your back leg, going all the way over your head, almost to your spine, shifting back forward and letting your hands just go.
Think of competitive axe throwing like a more extreme version of darts. Each match consists of three games. During each game, individual competitors hurl five axes, one at a time, at a wooden bullseye.
All right, guys, tap axes, throw when you're ready.
The game was brought to the States by Urban Axes co-founder Stuart Jones. He says he fell in love with axe throwing when he was visiting friends in Canada nearly 5 years ago.
The way the sport's played, the skills you acquire are not about strength. It's about technique and skill. So the great thing we find is that it's equal men and women about who can succeed.
Competitors typically go in groups of eight or more in a round-robin tournament, followed by an elimination round. Rose Jackson from Haddon Township, New Jersey, brought some friends for an unconventional 40th birthday party.
At first, my wife was like, let's go salsa dancing, Spanish food, restaurant. And I said, okay. But then when I saw this, I was like, you know what? I want to throw axes to bring in my 40th.
Aiming for the next target is Jackie Dabrowski of Philadelphia. She says even with more and more chains coming to the adjoining neighborhoods of Northern Liberties and Fishtown, there's still a high demand for businesses that are unique and quirky. So this fits in.
Basically, in this neighborhood, it's the crazier and the more you know, unique it is, the better.
Urban Axes may be unique, but it isn't crazy. Groups of players are given their own coach, called an expert, to make sure everyone stays safe and to keep score. They don't serve food or alcohol, but participants are allowed to bring in their own. Organizers insist they keep an eye on safety the whole time. Co-founder Stuart Jones says he plans to have players representing Urban Axes compete in the Axe Throwing Championship in Toronto next year. He says he isn't surprised the business is doing well in a city far away from logging country.
At the end of the day, the axe is kind of irrelevant. You've got a whole bunch of people coming together and socializing and sharing fun. That's what it's all about. The axe is just a medium to get them to do so.
For WHYY, I'm Rob Zavatsky.
Finally this evening, as the U.S. heads towards Inauguration Day, in Gettysburg, a different kind of political race is approaching. Come January 14th, wax figures of all 43 U.S. presidents and their first ladies will be auctioned off. It's the main collection of the Hall of Presidents and First Ladies Museum, which closed in November. The museum opened in 1957, in part to pay homage to one of Gettysburg's most famous residents, the 34th president, Dwight David Eisenhower. While the collection features life-size figures of each of the presidents, the first ladies are represented by only one-third scale figures, each dressed in a replica of their inaugural gowns. Pennsylvania On-Site Auctions, which is staging the auction, anticipates all 43 of the presidents will sell, though auctioneer Randy Dickensheets notes that, unlike our recent election results, the winner in this contest to garner the highest bid could go to a Republican, or a Democrat, or even a Whig president. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.